Radiotopia.
Welcome to the Kitchen Sisters present.
From PRX.
We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson
and Nikki Silva.
Hi, I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life in prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. The Kitchen Sisters Present is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're listening to Fugitive Waves, lost recordings and shards of sound, along with new tales of remarkable people from around the world. We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva.
Food. Mostly, we think of it as a necessity or a pleasure or an act of generosity. But there's a darker side to food as well. Famines that are started as acts of war, bakeries bombed in Syria, millions of people living in refugee camps around the world and being fed commodities in surplus, the sort of wearing away of their food traditions and humanity. We've been thinking of this so much these days with the anti-immigration fervor that's going on right now. The threats to register people of certain backgrounds and religions. This story came from a woman who was cutting Davia's hair. Her name's Akemi Tamarabuchi. She asked Davia about the work we were doing, and Davia told her about hidden kitchens, secret, underground, below the radar, how communities come together through food. Akemi looked at her and said, Weenie Royale. You need to know about Weenie Royale.
My name is Akemi Tamarabuchi, and I'm third generation Japanese American. During World War II, my family was interned in Tule Lake internment camp. I'm positive that so many of the dishes that I grew up eating stemmed from what they had in camp and how they incorporated that into their tastes. Fried bologna with a little sugar and a little soy sauce on top, hot dogs and everything. They use things like ketchup and hot water for soup bases. We eat ketchup on everything. Weenie Royale and Hamburger Royale, they're my favorites. Sunday mornings we always had sliced hot dogs mixed with eggs with soy sauce and a little oyster sauce, stir-fried in with some onions over rice.
My father was Ito Ikemoto. Everybody called him Ed. He made that his official name after the war. He was a grocer. He had 3 grocery stores, and he lost them all, of course. My name's Howard Ikemoto. After the war, a lot of the Japanese came back to places like Sacramento, and they had no jobs. And a lot of them got pickup trucks and became gardeners. And I was 12 years old. I would go every Saturday to work with my father. Every lunch, all the Japanese gardeners would meet in front of people that they were mowing lawns for. We used to eat rice with one plum in the middle, and then maybe have a slice of Spam, corned beef hash out of a can. That was part of our main diet in camp. And while they were having their lunch, they would talk about the camps. which was the prime of their life.
My name is Tammy Takahashi. I'm a native of San Francisco. I went to UC Berkeley in the 30s, the depths of depression. I lived my whole life here, except for the 4 years of World War II. Everybody, if they had a drop of Japanese blood, 1/16, we were all gathered up and put into camps. Our camp, Topaz, each person was given a tin pie plate that held our meals. Even now, 70 years later, if I look at a tin pie plate, it brings back memories.
My name is Moss Kawaguchi. I'm 79 years old. When I was evacuated, they sent me over to Tamfram Racetrack. I had to live in a stable 6 months. You could still see the hairs on the floor, and you could still smell the horses. They told us that you're supposed to bring your own mess gear. Being a Boy Scout, I knew what to bring. They had a big hall. All 8,000 of us had to march in there with your mess gear in hand.
You lined up for your food and then sat down at these long tables and ate there. Everybody squeezed in where they could. Just broke apart the family because the kids were running around. There was no family dinner.
Somebody else was cooking your dinner. It wasn't your mother. That part of the family life was just institutionalized. My name is Jean Wilkotsky Houston. I was 7 years old. We went to Manzanar. It was bleak, desert.
The cook in our mess hall and Block 11 was a Coast Guard military cook, a grizzly old cranky guy, not very friendly disposed to the idea of children and women. It was determined that only children from birth to 12 years of age would be given 6 ounces of milk maximum. And I was pregnant, but he wouldn't give me any milk.
We were very unused to eating potatoes. It's not something that was part of our regular diet. My father and mother ate rice every day of their life. Rice is certainly a soul food for Japanese Americans.
They had dirt floors in the barracks. My great-grandmother would dig a hole and ferment her own rice wine or sake and store it buried in the dirt. That was a big secret that wasn't allowed in the camps.
Every block had sake makers. Everybody had any connection with the mess hall. They scrape all the rice out of the bottom of the pan and they'll make sake. My name is Jim Yamaichi. I spent 3 years in Tui Lake. You see that concrete thing over there? There used to be a guard tower in that corner. That's the slaughterhouse where they slaughtered the hogs, rendering the fat. The soap was made right there and took into the mess hall. This is where the chicken coop used to be. Tui Lake was one of the biggest farm camps. We supplied most of all the vegetables to other camps. 3,800 acres of farmland. Internees did the farming. You'd bring a carload of hot dogs and come in by the tons, and we'd eat hot dogs for days, you know.
My father decided he was going to have a family dinner Christmas time, and he was going around the camp bragging to his friends that he was going to have a goose for Christmas. Everybody was mocking him. There was no place to cook a goose, and then where are you going to get a goose anyway, right? Tule Lake is a flyway for Canadian geese. So he dug this trench and laid down, put some gunny sack over himself, and put feed in the trench. And sure enough, the geese came down and their wings were trapped. My father threw the gunny sack onto the geese. Every barrack had this potbelly stove, and he actually roasted it in there. And we had our Christmas goose.
My name is Shosei Hanayama, minister of Watson Buddhist Temple. After World War II in Yokohama, so many Americans came, Army and Navy, and they brought, you know, a hot dog. It's an American cuisine, you know, every year, Independence Day. they have a contest in New York City. Japanese young guy, you know, every year he ate over 50 hot dogs he ate in a couple minutes.
This year's Nathan's hot dog eating contest. Takiro Kobayashi hoping to swallow the competition.
He'll show us a couple different looks. Right now he's Japanese-ing and solid-ing. He's breaking the dog in half, separating dog from bun. Still the man to be beat. He is the Lance Armstrong of our sport.
Some of my closest friends never even heard of the fact that the Japanese were interned. And there's so many things that have affected our culture, at least that came out of there, like the food. To be honest, I think that the Japanese culture is very silent. Nobody ever complains or talks about any bad times. And my grandmother, my oba-chan, she's 85 years old. Now she has all of a sudden become far more sensitive to wanting all of her family to understand where everything came from. You know, we lost so much of it. It's just like, call all the grandkids and Bachan's making weenie royale for breakfast. Come spend time so that you learn how to make this food so you can make it for your children and their children.
Jeannie Wachotsky Houston's best-selling book, Farewell to Manzanar, came out in 1973. It was one of the earliest memoirs revealing the story of the incarceration of the Japanese, and I think it was the first I ever heard of the internment. It pushed me to ask my mom, who grew up in the Bay Area, about the Japanese and what happened. She'd never talked to me about it before. My mom visibly slumped when I asked her. Her best friend in high school was taken away, there one day, gone the next. My mom never saw her again. Just a few months before she was taken away, the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. The war was exploding. My mom's boyfriend, my dad, was getting drafted. The politicians were adamantly insisting that locking up the Japanese was a matter of national security. There was nothing they could do about it, my grandmother told my mom. My mom, in her heart, never forgave herself for not finding her friend, for not speaking up. I'm thinking a lot about my mom these days. And how a whole nation of really good people, good, smart people, can find themselves swept up by events and rhetoric, standing by as unbelievable injustices happen all around them. Jeannie Wachotsky Houston is very much part of life here in the Santa Cruz area where Davia and I first started doing radio many years ago. We've interviewed Jeannie and her late husband, James Houston, who's a wonderful writer and novelist, many times. The two co-wrote Farewell to Manzanar, and the book is still one of the first ways young people are introduced to this dark chapter of our history. Here's a bit more of Jeannie's story.
When we were writing the book, we never imagined that it would be, you know, as well read as it is today. It was a very personal book about what had happened during the Second World War and the kind of secrecy that was around it, because, I mean, Jim didn't even know my experiences until we did the book. We knew each other 20 years before that. He was totally astounded when I asked him to give me help in writing this memoir, and he said, "What memoir?" And he had heard of camps. I don't think he even knew the word Manzanar, but he knew that there were some camps, because he grew up in San Francisco when he was about 7 or 8, and when his parents would drive by Tamfran, the horse racetrack, he was wondering what all these people were doing in there. His parents just got real quiet. That's all he remembered about it. I was 7 years old, youngest of 10 children. My father at that time had 2 fishing boats. We lived in Ocean Park in Southern California. My father loved celebrating all the holidays. I mean, he was so American that way, you know, and he loved the big round table in Ocean Park where we had Thanksgiving and Christmas. When the bombing of Pearl Harbor happened, the FBI came immediately and arrested my father. We didn't find out for several months later. He was taken to Fort Lincoln in North Dakota, a federal penitentiary, because he was a fisherman and, quote, an alien. Although he lived here for 35 years, he came to America from Japan in 1904 as a student. He never became a citizen because you couldn't You had to be born in the country. J. Edgar Hoover, he had a whole list, like they do right now, I'm sure. They had names listed. Just in several weeks, the family had changed its configuration. All my brothers and sisters now were no longer living with us. Several of my sisters got married when they started doing the internment because they had boyfriends. They wanted to stay with them, so they married them. For me, one of the most destructive things that happened was the breakup of the family. My father disappears. He comes back a drunk. We don't eat together as a family. You're bathing together with a whole bunch of strangers. Well, it must be like what the refugee camps are now, except we had guns pointed at us and we were within a barbed wire. I remember asking my mother, why were we in the prison camp? What did we do wrong? She said, it's because we're Japanese. From that moment on, in my childish mind, it was not only bad to be Japanese, it was criminal.
Most of us know George Takei as Sulu, the helmsman of the USS Enterprise in Star Trek. Takei is also a trustee and chairman emeritus of the Japanese American National Museum in LA. He's part of the last generation of Japanese Americans interned during World War II. And he feels he has a special responsibility to make sure this story is not forgotten. He says, it's vitally important for a democracy to learn from those chapters where we failed. This is part of our history, and we need to learn it. This is an excerpt from an interview that was done as part of the Archive of American Television.
I grew up here in Los Angeles until Pearl Harbor. I was four at the time, too young to really understand what was going on. But I still do remember that day when soldiers with guns, bayonets on them, came to our home to order us out. And we were taken to a horse stable at San Anita Racetrack, where we were housed for a few months while the camps were being built. When the camp was built, we were put on a train and taken all the way across the southwestern desert to the swamps of Arkansas, a camp called Rower. And then we were transferred from that camp to another camp in Northern California called Tule Lake, which was an even more harsh camp. There were three levels of barbed wire fence and tanks patrolling the perimeter.
Why were you transferred from Camp Rower?
There's a dark chapter of American history in that. Immigrants coming to the United States could all aspire to someday becoming naturalized American citizens, except one group of immigrants, immigrants from Asia. At that time, Chinese and Japanese immigrants to the United States could not be naturalized. When the war broke out, young Japanese American men and women rushed to volunteer to serve in the U.S. Army. But because we looked like the enemy, we were rejected from service, classified as 4C, which means enemy non-alien. Now that's a very peculiar term, non-alien. It means a citizen. We couldn't even be called enemy citizens. And we were all incarcerated. But a year into internment, the government realized they had a manpower shortage. So they came down with what was called a loyalty questionnaire. It was a series of about 40 questions. There were two key questions. Question 27 asked, will you bear arms to defend the United States of America? Question 28, and this was only one sentence, but it had two ideas. It asked, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? Now, for a Japanese American, someone born and raised here, the word forswear your loyalty to the Emperor was very offensive. Because it assumed that by birth you were ingrained with an inborn loyalty to the emperor. I mean, you know, you can't forswear something that doesn't exist. And so if you answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the emperor to forswear, you were also saying no to the first part. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered yes, meaning yes, I will be loyal, you were, fessing up. that you had been loyal to the emperor and the government was justified in putting you in an internment camp. It turned all 10 camps into turmoil. My father, as I said, was born in Japan and ineligible for citizenship. He said, they've taken my property, my home, everything. There's one thing that they can't take, my dignity. I am not going to grovel before this government. And he answered no to those two questions. And my mother, a young mother with three young children, one a baby, you know, they expect her to go off and carry a gun and fight. She said, this is nonsense. And she also answered no to those two key questions. And because of that, we were removed from the camp in Arkansas to the camp in Northern California. And that's why they had three layers of barbed wire fence. We were disloyal.
Weenie Royale was produced by the Kitchen Sisters in collaboration with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell, mixed by Jim McKee. Thanks to the Television Academy Foundation and their online archive of TV legends and pioneers, metvlegends.com. Special thanks to the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. So much of the programming you hear on public radio and from the Kitchen Sisters is because of the NEA and the NEH that support artists, scholars, humanists, and public media.
Radiotopia is made possible with support from the Knight Foundation and MailChimp, who celebrate creativity, chaos, and teamwork.
Thanks to AdCirc for providing their ad-serving platform to Radiotopia.
If you'd like to become a sponsor of Fugitive Waves or other shows like it, email sponsor@prx.org.
Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia.